The Human Podcast features weekly service audio from the Unitarian Universalist Metro Atlanta North Congregation of Roswell, Georgia. Please visit us at human.org.
Emails at 9:30 at night because I'm too lazy to go to my car and to the broader world that so desperately needs what we have in Unitarian Universalism. So there's a table set up outside. Our dear Jennifer Philippi and Martin Bildorowski will be out there. I want you to pick up the envelope with your name on it. If we miss you, do not even worry about it. We'll send you something as a follow-up. It has just a very brief glimpse and a snapshot of what your board is trying to do with your money for the upcoming year and what we have for revenue for this current year. So it's just a cute little chart, and it will help you understand what the priorities are. Martin will be emailing it to you as well, and he will also send you a link to the Breeze Pledge form. So for those of you who are Breeze challenged, Denise,
yes, some of us are,
there are also printed pledge documents out there, so you can pick up a paper pledge form as well. We would like to make your generosity as easy as humanly possible. So who knows, if you decide to do just a little more love, a little more time, a little more money, you might be surprised at how much light fills your heart and the world around you when you move from charity to generosity. I'm actually thinking of trying it this year.
The reading this morning is from See No Stranger by Valerie Kaur, who is a Sikh American activist for justice. Brand new book out, is wonderful. It was New Year's Eve 2016. My friend, Reverend William Barber II, had invited me to speak at the Metropolitan AMA Church, an historic black church in Washington, D.C. I looked out at the crowded church and I saw grief, and I saw anticipation in people's eyes. The future is dark, I said, but what if this darkness is not the darkness of the tomb, but the darkness of the womb? What if all of our grandfathers and grandmothers are standing behind us now, those who survived occupation and genocide, slavery and Jim Crow, detentions and political assault? What if they are whispering in our ear, "You are brave"? What if this is our nation's greatest transition? The crowd erupted in cheers and shouts and cries of "Alleluia!" What does the midwife tell us to do? I cried out over the roar, "Breathe and then push." In the weeks that followed, the address was viewed about 40 million times around the world, and my words began to appear on protest signs. I received thousands of inquiries asking, how do we breathe? How do we push? And how do we keep laboring for justice when we feel hopeless? Here ends the reading for this morning. Week, haven't we, in Alabama? So, the television viewership in America for things royal in England are not the same, of course, as the multi-million viewers of professional football. I understood that this year's Super Bowl was the largest viewership for anything ever in this country. But respectably huge nonetheless, royal coronation. So Prince Charles finally gets to be king. We had one of those coronations. And then there was the royal funeral of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II. And then royal weddings, the last one, the nuptials of Prince Harry and Meghan in 2018. How many of you got up early on a Saturday morning and watched? It was really cool. There was like pomp and circumstance, and then there was gospel music. And she looked great. Everybody looked great. I'm sorry that their marriage isn't doing better. That's another sermon. In the meantime, in another wing of the often beleaguered contemporary Windsor family that year, there was the other rapidly being eclipsed royal news, the recent birth of third child to Prince William and his Duchess, and the pull to stream another enormously popular British public television import, Call the Midwife. How many of you watched Call the Midwife? Yay! Since it's been reported that Kate Middleton's first two babies were delivered, yes, she had called a midwife. Did you know that? Her babies all came from a midwife. Let's applaud her for her, of course. So here's a huge confession to a UU crowd. Are you ready to be forgiving of me? I am not a big PBS or BBC masterpiece or any other British TV fan. But having faithfully followed Downton Abbey on the recommendation of my decidedly not a PBS devotee, Gen X daughter, for its entire six seasons, I was searching around to fill the Sunday evening comfort television slot and ran across Call the Midwife, same time, same station. After a holiday episode teaser in December, its 13th season is due to air weekly in this country the end of March. We're waiting. The end of March, it starts again. This PBC series is based on a memoir by Jennifer Worth, who worked as a nurse midwife with the community of St. John the Divine, an Anglican religious order founded in 1849. But we pick up their story and their work in the impoverished Cockney East End of London, in the period between the end of World War II into the 1960s and now a bit beyond. It captures the day-to-day lives of these women in the blitz bomb devastation and urban poverty of that time in London, in the wider context of the post-war baby boom, the beginning of immigration out of former colonies, the founding of the British National Health Service in 1945, and perhaps most important, the sea change in reproductive health and choices that came with the introduction of the birth control pill in London in 1956. Each episode focuses on a delivery or one or two. There has actually been up to six deliveries on an episode. More than 100 on-screen simulated births, two stillbirths employing both real and prosthetic babies created from the same medical-grade silicone used to make artificial limbs. Did you know that's what they do? And a drawer full of pretend umbilical cords in different sizes. Beyond portrayals of pregnancy and childbirth through the eyes of the bike-riding or mostly bike-riding midwives, we see miscarriages, we see stillbirths, birth defects, unwanted pregnancies. Actually, one episode had a back-alley abortion. The show also has taken on, with, I think, great accuracy and so much warmth, don't you think? So much compassion on that show, but unremitting poverty, disease epidemics, prostitution, incest, alcoholism, disability, homosexuality, female genital mutilation, religion and racism. And I know if there was an episode for today on Call the Midwife, they would take that Alabama case that just happened where they're calling in vitro fertilization personhood. And they would do a splendid job with accuracy and compassion on an issue that I think is going to gain a lot of traction in the weeks ahead. Delving into the context and issues surrounding their mission of bringing babies safely into the world, better lives, healthier families, and sustainable communities. Beyond living into the core definition of midwifery, the act and art of assisting births, the sisters of order and secular midwives who live and work beside them live into a second, more expansive definition, the art, act, and process of bringing forth or bringing about, in particular, reproductive justice. Reproductive justice, how many of you are familiar with that term? Well, good. You know, I spoke last week to my own congregation and almost nobody knew that. So good for you. Reproductive justice, described by Loretta Ross, founder of the Sister Song Women of Color Health Collective, as, quote, the complete physical, mental, spiritual, and economic well-being of women and girls based on the full achievement and protection of women's human rights, including the right to have a child and including the right not to have a child, the right to parent the children we have with empathy and excellence, as well as to control our birthing options, such as midwifery. There's a book that came out a few years ago called The Little Book of Feminist Saints by Julia Pierpoint, which is a short, vibrant, and surprising biography of 99 matron saints, champions of strength, she writes, of progress, which highlights women who broke ground and broke molds. It honors familiar and less familiar Sherwins. And raise your hand if you know these people. Artists like Mary Cassatt. Writers like Audre Lorde. Scientists like Rachel Carson. Activists like Ida B. Wells and Pussy Riot. Other pioneers like Mary Edwards Walker, who was named the matron saint of surgeons, who was initially denied her rightful medical credentials as a field doctor. And then we are all invited by the author to name our own feminist saint as the 100th, so honored. So I would like to challenge you to shout out your 100th saint, and I'll try to capture some of them. Who would be your 100th saint out of 100 feminist saints? Eleanor Roosevelt. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Who? Ruby Bridges. Maya Angelou. Great. You get the point. It's kind of an ingenious way of hooking people into your book. I thought that was great. I nominated not one woman, but the historic legion of midwives. As a descriptor and the descriptor womanist to identify so many of them. Womanists defined as black feminists or feminists of color who oppose sexism in communities of color and racism within the feminist community. So there's one midrash. A midrash is a story written into the Bible in Judaism based on Hebrew scripture told by a rabbi, Michael Strassfeld. And it all goes back to the Garden of Eden. He proposes that after Eve was made to suffer the pains of childbirth as a result, as a punishment for what? Telling Adam that he should eat the apple from the tree of knowledge. So she goes through the pains of childbirth with Cain and Abel all alone. And later when birthing her daughters all alone, she has daughters. She has daughters in this story. She taught them to find another woman to be with them in labor and name this person not a mid-husband, but a midwife. And thus, the real oldest profession in the world began. Not the one we usually think about, but midwifery. It was and has been a tortured vocation over the centuries, fought for by women who I believe deserve what we call secular canonization. They've been around since the start of human history. In 16th century Europe, elder females who were called good sibs, the original word for gossip, recognizing the function they served both as community news bearers and literal lifesavers. So they were going around birthing babies and hearing all the news and talking to people, good sibs. In Victorian England, the unsanitary conditions in so-called lying-in hospitals and childbirth fever was so rampant that it drove upper-class women, including the queen, countesses, duchesses, baronesses, and other royals, back into midwife care and safer home births after they'd sort of started to go to hospitals. Here in the U.S. and abroad, midwives were valued members of their communities until the 19th century in the States, when childbirth became more professionalized and doctors' groups began pushing for a monopoly in obstetric care. They began vilifying midwives who were largely immigrants, or in the American South, black women who were known as grannies, who were dismissed and caricatured, told that they had fingers full of dirt and brains full of arrogance and superstition. By the 1950s, the majority of American births were in the hospital. How many of you were born in a hospital? How many of you were born at home? There you go. By the 1970s and 80s, there was some return to popularity for home births that were overseen by midwives among progressive, middle-class, white urban women, mostly. While in England and Canada, midwife births account for about 50% still, here in the United States, it hovers around 10%. Never having recovered from the years of slander and vilification, the echoes of middle-aged witchcraft, accusations of dirty fingerprints, a small and persistent group of feminist women as saints. Very small. In my adult life, I have traveled to Washington, D.C. and its Capitol Mall several times as a Unitarian Universalist to demonstrate, to march, to speak out for reproductive rights and the larger issue of reproductive justice. In April 1989, how many of you went to the march in 1989 in Washington? That was the first big abortion rights march, 1989. A large chunk of the women in my family camped in my brother's Maryland basement, mothers and daughters and aunts and sister-in-laws joining a half a million others to call for abortion rights. It was almost 30 years before my daughter and I met up again in D.C., before COVID made these kind of gatherings basically too risky, for the so-called March for Moms, which was never a march, but really a rally gathering of prominent OBs and nurse midwives and politicians and survivors of maternal morbidity near death from childbirth and families of those who didn't survive. There was a father left with two young sons to raise there. There was a grandmother who lost her only daughter there. At the same site where I marched all those years before in the company of thousands, on the same site where the Women's March had taken place with another multitude early in 2017, were there people there? 2017 March? Yeah. Now, how many of you went to the one in Atlanta? Some of us did that. This time around, there were only a few hundred spread across the vast lawn. The banner over the stage read, Lost Mothers, recounting the 2016 statistics on 164 American women, known ones, who had died giving birth that year, and the more than 900 others whose identities are still unknown. The anonymous 65,000 to 80,000 near lost ones whose lives were critically threatened, who may well have suffered permanent damage, but who survived, including my own daughter. Including my own daughter, the same daughter who as a teenager had recounted her experiences for National Public Radio during that massive pro-choice march. My only daughter who, because of good insurance and premium medical care and an advantaged social and geographic location, did not bleed to death during a critically endangered pregnancy, who along with some famous fortunate other women like Kim Kardashian and more recently Serena Williams experienced the medical and emotional trauma of long hospital stays and separation from their families. She couldn't hold her own baby for the first 2 months of her baby's life and will undoubtedly face post-traumatic stress that will haunt them from years to come. There were mothers and fathers and grandparents and babies there that day, all sharing the same experience of death or near death in pregnancy. So there I was that Sunday afternoon, wouldn't miss it, while saddened and angered by the low turnout and the lack of media coverage, but heartened by the weekend I saw of storytelling by those survivors who found each other over meals, in hotel lobbies, on the mall, sharing their tales of damaged or lost organs, transfusions, near death. And as always, the midwives in their bright orange March for Mom shirts, cheering the women like my daughter on, the survivors and their families, all of us practicing metaphorical midwifery by our presence, by our collective witness against reproductive injustice. Witnessing all of us publicly to truth that more U.S. women are dying from pregnancy and childbirth complications each year. Truth that the maternal death rate has more than doubled in the past decade and most of the tragic deaths were preventable. Truth that the U.S. has the highest rate of women dying or just after childbirth than in any other country due to poor access to health care, due to provider shortages, due to economic inequities due to inadequate housing, less availability of good foods, and the stressors of racism. Truth that Georgia ranks 50, second only to the District of Columbia. Truth that Black and Native women are 3 or 4 times more likely to die in childbirth. A hideous disparity, don't you agree? Every day and over time, midwives have witnessed to these injustices and then practiced age-old methods and demonstrated age-old attitudes that point the way to better outcomes, less sorrow, and fewer tragedies. If we had only listened to their wisdom, enabled them to do their work of feminist, womanist sainthood. There was a report that came out by ProPublica that told us that full incorporation of midwives in healthcare system could prevent more than 80% of maternal and newborn deaths worldwide. Why do you think that's true? Well, one of the reasons is that midwives look at pregnancy and beyond and birth as a normal process, not as a medical event. It could go wrong at any time. They are less likely to approach childbirth in terms of scheduling, inconvenience, and maximizing insurance reimbursements, and more in terms of an ongoing close relationship between a midwife and a mother. Listening to women, trusting what they tell us. Where have we heard that before recently? As a core commitment, which might at least lessen the impact of systemic racial bias. The ignoring and the disbelieving and the othering of women, especially women of color. The work of change is far from over. The work, we are told, of expanded access to care and managing chronic conditions and policy changes and increased research and more. And then perhaps returning to licensing midwives in Georgia for hospital privileges. While at one time in Georgia there were at least 600 Black midwives, after the elimination of midwife licensing many years ago in this state, there are a few community midwives left, but only a handful of Black practitioners. Following the March for Moms, in some symbolic and relational way, so rich, but in size and public impact, so disappointing, I asked my daughter, I said, Alicia, growing forward, are we all called to midwife? She answered very simply and very directly, Mom, you know that tone? Mom, show up. Mom, be informed. Mom, care. Circling back to the larger definition of what it means to be a midwife, may we all honor the art, act, and process of bringing forth or bringing about. To give or receive compassion, strength, calm, painstaking kindness, honor, and peace, that's midwifery. As we answer the call as Unitarian Universalists to achieve reproductive justice and the human right to worth and dignity, let us be moved by the thousands of activist, feminist, womenist saints before us. And in the words of a prophetic sister, may we honor the work of taking care of each other with revolutionary love. May it be so.
And now would you please join me as we extinguish our chalice? Thank you. We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again.
As we go out into a new week, be kind, be brave, be just, be merciful, be hopeful, and no matter your gender, be a midwife.
The Unitarian Universalist Metro Atlanta North Congregation of Roswell, Georgia, thanks you for listening to the Human Podcast. Background music, courtesy of Tim Moore from Pixabay.